This week on Making Contact.
Globalization itself has become an economics of death, but it is also a dying economy, both internally at the heart of the corporations who want to take over, as well as those they leave victim.
For several years now, social movements that oppose corporate globalization have been articulating what they are against and why, but few alternatives to rules and policies set forth by the World Bank and International Monetary Fund have entered the public discourse. That's beginning to change, say many proponents of fair trade policies and democratic rights. On this edition of Making Contact, we'll hear from two key advocates of alternatives to economic globalization, physicist Vandana Shiva and economist John Kavanagh. I'm Philip Babbitt, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. In many ways, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and more broadly, the so-called war on terrorism, have overshadowed critical issues raised by international movements that oppose corporate globalization. Nonetheless, thousands of non-governmental organizations and community-based groups continue to mobilize people around the world to oppose international trade agreements that largely benefit multinational corporations. Vandana Shiva, founder and director of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy in New Delhi, India, is a physicist and ecologist, a highly influential organizer and speaker within the anti-corporate globalization movement. Shiva was the recipient of the 1993 Right Livelihood Award, also known as the Alternative Nobel Prize. What follows is an excerpt from a talk she gave at the World Affairs Council in San Francisco on April 4, 2003. Shiva drew on a common anti-war slogan used to oppose the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
The phrase that has emerged in the peace movement is there should be no blood for oil. The problem is globalization is turning everything into oil. Yeah? When they talk about biodiversity being used by the biotech industry, being patented by the gene giants, being genetically manipulated, the word that's used for biodiversity is green oil. When they talk about privatizing water, commodifying it and selling it, the word used is blue gold or blue oil, that water will be the oil of the future. Oil has become the metaphor. Oil is the metaphor of globalization. And if the oil economy and the fossil fuel economy that has been so much at the part of non-sustainability, the denial of rights and the emergence of corporate rule. Corporations could never have had the power they have if we had stayed in biodiversity economies. We will see increasingly the conversion of all our economies, our biodiversity economies, our water economies, our people's economies, our women's economies into oil-centered economies. We'll see blood for seeds. We are seeing blood for seeds. Our organization's done this study of people committing suicide because the new economy of seeds makes farming unviable, gets people into debt. People selling kidneys just to buy seeds. Now, that's the way Monsanto, Syngenta get the $1 trillion increase market. They get it by squeezing blood out of the poor. In the same way for water, the new markets for water are created by denying people water. The jugglery in economics about it is people have had things for free for too long. Now they should start paying. There should be full cost accounting. And this is really bringing efficiency and conservation into the natural resource picture. It's not true. First of all, having water for free from a river, like the Ganges, does not mean you devalue the river. We still hold it sacred. In fact, the day you start to market it, you have devalued it. But this logic of full cost accounting is not working anyway. Let me just give you two quick examples. There's a new plant being set up in Delhi by Suez, which is one of the big water giants. And this is going to get access to 635 million liters of Ganges water. The argument of full cost accounting is only they have the 2 billion rupees to invest in that plant. But to get water into that plant, there's a public investment of 1,000 billion rupees for the dam that was built, which has displaced 100,000 people, all public cost, all social costs, and has led in the last few years to 100 women committing suicide for lack of water in the catchment of that dam. I've just come from that area right now from having public hearings with the women who've been displaced and whose water lines have been cut off so that the last drop of water can start flowing to the through the canal system. And the 2 billion that Suez will invest is already compensated by 2 billion annually of the crop losses and agriculture losses, because the water being used for agriculture will start going into the city to be sold at high profits. So if the Coca-Colas, when they bottle water, or the Suez's when they sell water, if they were to do a full cost accounting, and that's one of my future campaigns, we're going to make bills of full cost accounting, and I'm going to march with the women from Tehri and from the hills, whose lives have been devastated, to say, you want to pay us to pay the full price? Well, here's the full price. Because privatization cannot work if the full price was paid to nature, if the full cost were paid to nature, if the full cost were paid to community, and if, in paying those full costs, permission was sought of local community, can we do this with your water? Can we do this with your biodiversity? And we are basically saying, we do not give you permission. We do not give you permission to commodify our water. We do not give you permission to patent our life forms. We do not give you permission to enter with your toxics and our your genetically engineered seeds. And those are the combinations of alternatives that are both, you know, provided the inspiration for the report and will be supported further as the work on alternatives grows. The alternatives are really two. One, the alternatives we build in our minds, how we think differently about the world, and the alternatives we build with our hands. So much of what is being privatized is not privatizable. It's not commodifiable. And bringing it back to the commons is the big challenge. In concrete sense, for example, in India, it's meaning that rural communities that we work with in Navdanya are basically saying our biodiversity is our common heritage. We'll protect it, we'll utilize its sustainability, but we will not allow anyone else to patent it, and we will not respect any regime of monopoly. We will not treat our saving our seeds, our using our knowledge as a crime. We will celebrate it, and we will build other economies on the basis of it. We will build living economies, we will build living cultures, we are building living democracy. If you travel to the mountains, and I hope some of you will visit, you can go up to the high-altitude villages, and one remote hut, you'll say, Monsanto, stay out. Yeah, not allowed. Not allowed. Way up in the mountains, where Monsanto's not even reaching yet, but they're prepared. Hundreds of villages are just basically saying, we are GM-free villages, patent-free villages, chemical-free villages, corporate-free villages. Part of the epidemic of globalization is, if we can do something very simply at low cost, we are made to believe, no, you need 5 billion to do it. And since only the corporations have it, you're incapable. Sit aside, let your municipalities be taken over, let your universities be taken over, let your villages be taken over. And India, of course, has got into that act and designed a $200 billion new scheme of linking every river one from the other, taking Ganges water to Kaveri, taking Kaveri water somewhere else. It generates hell of a lot of growth, uses a lot of cement, but will leave every river dead and every community supported by the Ganges, by the Mahanadi, by the Krishna, totally dispossessed. So part of our alternatives work is we are traveling through the rivers, we are traveling along the rivers and holding public hearings. We are creating water parliaments. And after we've done the water parliaments, we don't have to wait till the actual parliaments. You can create congresses in your communities. By the time the year ends when the government will present its report for starting to build these 200-meter canals through the length and breadth of India, we will be ready with the people's report. A report which will say, no, this is how we democratically decide to conserve our water, because conservation has no place in privatization. There's rewards on exploitation, there's rewards for selling, but there's no reward for conserving. So if we need economies of conservation, we've got to move to something else. And our plans that we are building will be taking conservation efforts, equity in distribution, and through it, building the peace that is necessary, because diverting waters on that scale is a sure recipe for water wars. You know, while India is talking about bringing rivers southwards, China is talking about taking the rivers northwards. And of course, I'm sure Bechtel and Suez are telling both governments they need to do that. Same rivers, especially the Brahmaputra. I see globalization and the model that it has given rise to in economics and culture as really globalization itself has become an economics of death. But it is also a dying economy, both internally at the heart of the corporations who want to take over, as well as those they leave victim of their impact. It's creating dying democracy, if democracies haven't already died in certain places. It's creating cultures of death, and the war in Iraq is, you know, you can just see the relish for those who are behind it. They love it. They celebrate death and destruction and see in it a liberation. I've called this the patriarchal illusion of creation. That you kill and destroy and say, I've created. But it's also leading to dying cultures, those cultures which could help us find a different way. And the alternative practices as well as the alternative worldviews, I like to frame it in the language of earth democracy. That we are being told we are only connected to the through the supermarket. Walmart's everywhere, Starbucks everywhere. We don't get connected by that, we get disconnected. We get disconnected from the earth, we get disconnected from our communities, we get disconnected in fear from ourselves. That is not a connection. Globalization is not connecting people worldwide. What we need is connection, but connection can only happen through secure people, at peace with themselves, able to look into the tomorrow, and not just their tomorrows, the tomorrows of their children, and know there will be no harm. It's only out of that that you get connection. Only out of that you can reach out. Only that out of that you can have a circle of compassion. So we talk of replacing the economies of death with living economies, the dying democracies with living democracies, and the cultures of death with living cultures. Even while we do experience one of the worst periods of violence, the worst periods of degradation in human history, I think we are also being offered an opportunity that humanity has never had before, to reinvent our lives in ways that are deeply local in our responsibilities and experience, but deeply global in the way we both redefine common human agendas as well as connect ourselves at the level of planetary survival. Thank you.
Vandana Shiva of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy, speaking at the World Affairs Council in San Francisco on April 4th, 2003. We'll have more on alternatives to economic globalization in a few moments. You are listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information about this program, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for CD or cassette copies. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Vandana Shiva is among a group of 19 researchers, policy analysts, economists, and activists who have published a book that's intended to define new directions for the anti-corporate globalization movement. It's called Alternatives to Economic Globalization, A Better World is Possible. The release of the book comes at a time when organizers are planning counter-events to coincide with the next ministerial meeting of the World Trade Organization in September 2003 in Cancun, Mexico. Central to the book's vision is a list of 10 principles for sustainable societies. There are also specific proposals for dealing with existing international financial institutions. One idea is to establish an international bankruptcy court so indebted poor nations can negotiate fair terms rather than sink further into debt and accept economic restructuring as mandated by the International Monetary Fund. At a book release event in January 2003, John Cavanna, who co-chaired the drafting committee of Alternatives to Economic Globalization, mentioned several other ideas.
Another one, just for example, that we would shift into the UN that doesn't exist at all now, is an office of corporate accountability. An office where in the UN, you could coordinate amongst countries antitrust actions. You could work on enforceable global codes against corporations. You could come up with new proposals for taxation that keep corporations from avoiding taxes here by reincorporating in places like Bermuda, and new examples of chartering regimes. So we would put that together in the UN. All in all, there's a very rich menu of proposals. Now, you're all sitting there asking, is this just pie in the sky, or can we get traction behind these proposals? And I'd like to devote the remainder of my remarks to this issue. And to those of you who know me, it won't come as a surprise that I have some good news here, I think, on the possibilities, the political possibilities. Up until a few years ago, and this is stunning to me to think back, because many of us were together here in the Bay Area in a big teach-in only 5 years ago. So think back just 5 years ago. This so-called Washington Consensus on free trade appeared unassailable at that point. It manifested its power in government, across governments, business, media, academic circles, the world over. Reagan, Thatcher, and Kohl took power just two short decades ago by arguing that governments should get out of the economy, that markets should be unleashed, and that what was good for global corporations was good for the people. Regulations were dismantled, privatization was unleashed. The World Bank and IMF were given new powers to press this agenda overseas. We got NAFTA, the World Trade Organization, all setting up new corporate rights while imposing no responsibility on corporations to communities, workers, or the environment. The Dark Ages. Now, just 5 years after that seemed unassailable, this paradigm is unraveling. And I think part, it was so damaging to workers, the environment, the poor, women, small farmers, and so on, that it's generated a huge citizen backlash. And the momentum of history clearly has shifted from the corporate suites to the city streets. This backlash has momentum, and I would argue that it has turned around the debate on free trade, on debt cancellation, on pharmaceutical mega profits, and on the course of economies everywhere. Now, why do I feel this concretely? Well, the old paradigm has been assailed in these 5 years by a relentless barrage of hammer blows, really since 1999, and it is reeling. And just to mention a few of the prominent pieces of this that have delegitimated these institutions around the world, the Asian financial crisis, 97, 98, starting with Thailand, whole economies collapsing under the financial casino, with the International Monetary Fund across Asia seen as the prime culprit. Next, the collapse of the Mexican economy, the spectacular collapse of Argentina and its economy just a year and a half ago, both poster children of the World Bank and IMF. Next, last year, and we've forgotten this already in the media's obsession with Iraq, the Enron and the other corporate scandals. In just the past year, We have witnessed a remarkable spate of corporate scandals after corporate scandal. The chief executive officer has gone from celebrity cover boy to cornered criminal, with Ken Lay, Jeffrey Skilling, and Jack Welch leading the reversal. Stock options, once a key component of the dot-com American dream, were recently referred to in a Washington Post story as innovative looting. This is a huge cultural change. It is huge. Next, the victory of Lula and the other anti-free trade regimes in other parts of Latin America. The election of Lula, a former metal worker, as president of the world's eighth largest economy, I think hammered one of the final nails in the coffin of that old paradigm. Lula's victory, keep in mind, means not only a great deal for the millions of poor Brazilians, he holds the key to dramatically shifting the debate in the Western Hemisphere away from the corporate integration model of NAFTA in the free trade area of the Americas to models of development based on dignity and sustainability and diversity. So this is huge. And finally, this growth of a vibrant citizen backlash to corporate globalization, many different streams over the past 20 years leading to the great convergence in Seattle, where we all added up to more than the sum of our parts, and beyond. So all of those things, who could have seen them, who could have foreseen them just 5 short years ago? Now, concretely, let me say just a few more words on how these hammer blows have punctured the key tenets of the old paradigm, the old free trade paradigm. There were 3 core tenets of that paradigm, summed up in these 3 very boring, technical-sounding words: deregulation, liberalization, privatization. But again, just to pause for a moment, deregulation. This was the centerpiece of Ronald Reagan. Get rid of government. Let corporations be free. The corporate scandals have erased this. Polls show that the word regulation is back. People want government checks. The only debate is over how much. So that, one of the key triangles of this model. Liberalization, in terms of finance, again, as recently as 7 or 8 years ago, the IMF, the World Bank, the US government were pressing countries to open up their economies, their financial sectors, to all kinds of, a kind of casino economy. It's been a disaster. And even the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, is admitting that it made mistakes. We've won the debate that countries should be able to exert some controls. Also on finance, around debt, we have won the moral argument that the poor of poor countries should not be forced to pay the debts incurred by their rich dictators to foreign banks. That is accepted, widely accepted around the world. And finally, around privatization, the Enron scandal, more than any other single event, exposed to the world the horrible bankruptcy of a model where an Enron went in with US government money and World Bank money, took over the water systems, the electricity systems of countries, jacked up rates, gave bad service, and then ultimately went bankrupt. So in 5 short years, we have chipped away significantly at the core tenets of the free trade paradigm. Let me end with a few thoughts on how we keep the debate shifting in our direction and how we try to move more action, more policy wins in our direction. Just a few concluding thoughts. The first is, and I think we're all grappling with this, we need to expand the sense of who our team is. I think we all have a better sense now of this Seattle coalition, that there are common interests among environmentalists, among workers, among students, amongst religious activists, women, health activists, and so on. But we've in some ways felt we were working against everybody else, against governments, against the rest of the world. The shift, our new allies, and this began to emerge in Seattle when a few developing country governments began to stand up and say enough, is that the Lula victory, the Gutierrez victory, the emergence of more independent voices in third world governments after really 2 decades of submission to the Washington consensus is a remarkably powerful new force. You can't impose. When NAFTA was passed, you had unanimous support from the governments of Canada, the US, and Mexico. Today, when you walk into a free trade area of the Americas negotiation, you've got Venezuela over there saying, we don't really want this. You have Brazil, you have Argentina, you have Ecuador. You have a completely different map. And we have some allies, important allies, in developing country governments. In addition, we have progressive forces in rich country governments. In Canada, the parliament backed a whole new set of proposals to put checks on the financial casino, the so-called Tobin tax. And we have progressive elements in our governments here at every level. And the force, the countervailing power that will bring the changes we need will be creative coalitions of our growing and emerging global Seattle coalition with those government forces from both poor and rich countries. So that's one. Second, we can't be content that we've shifted the debate some. We've got to continue. We have to continue to delegitimate. That is a huge task. Global corporations, the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO. We need to be ready when the next corporate scandal comes. AOL, Time Warner, whichever it is going to collapse this year in with sparks of the sort that were thrown off by Enron and WorldCom, and we have to be ready to use that moment to put forward our alternatives to further delegitimate. Just a couple more thoughts. One, we have to be focused in key blocking actions. We lost Fast Track, this authority that gives the U.S. president negotiating authority on trade agreements. But it was just a procedural vote. It wasn't a trade agreement. They want trade agreements now, and they're focused on two things that they want to bring before us all in 2005, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, and a new expanded powers in the World Trade Organization. These can be stopped, but we can't wait till 2005. It's a long, steady buildup of education, of mobilizing. And finally, on alternatives, we have to be collectively figuring out the next possible wins in these 5 years, concretely, in agriculture and energy and transport and elsewhere. We are all laying the foundations of alternative sustainable societies. A better world is possible. Thank you very much.
John Cabana is co-chair of the drafting committee of the book Alternatives to Economic Globalization, A Better World is Possible, a report from the International Forum on Globalization. If you want more information about this book, we'll be giving out our toll-free number in a moment. That's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at alternatives to economic globalization. Thanks for listening. And special thanks to Kimberly Ross and Roslyn Fay for recorded portions. If you would like more information about the subject of this week's program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Peggy Law, founding director, associate producer Amy Pomerleau, office manager Rosalind Fay, associate manager Susanna Hines, senior advisor Norman Solomon, national producer David Barsamian, and I'm managing producer Philip Babich. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Until next time,